have police photographing our license plates.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is a professional in the arts who has worn many hats quite successfully. Please welcome Alessandra Pasquino, a fellow Italian. How are you, Alessandra?
Very nice to talk to you.
Well, great talking to you, too. We definitely are going to talk about the feature-length documentary that premiered October 3rd of this year, Bitter Honey. But because this is sort of a partner interview with one I've done with Bitter Honey's director, Robert Lemelson. But Alessandra has done quite a few things. So first, I'd kind of like to start talking about some of the things you've done. For instance, you've studied in Middlesex University, yes, in London?
Yes, I started in London and I had, my background really is in fine art, particularly in performance and new media type of art. So I come from and theater as well. I did a lot of theater studies, I started acting, so I come to filmmaking from a rather varied and original type of background.
Yes, and you've collaborated on video works that have been featured, right, in the New Contemporary Show at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London. That's rather...
Yes. One of the things I was most interested in is collaborative art as a medium. So I conducted a lot of experimentation with this particular medium. I created works that combined performance, video, and film photography.
Yes.
And eventually this type of work evolved more towards a more traditional type of performance, such as acting, which is what brought me to research and eventually study acting.
Now,
go ahead.
No, you continue. I'll remember my question.
Yeah, so, I came from a rather experimental background to acting, then to directing theater, and then to filmmaking.
Very good.
So it's,
So what is your affinity with Uta Hagen?
I was interested in finding ways of working with improvisation and with method acting. I've always been drawn towards understanding and using, reality as it unfolds in art, which is, I guess, one of the things that eventually brought me to documentary. So studying Uta Hagen, her method of acting was really to do with finding personal connections to emotions that would be then expressed in whichever type of acting, character acting you would be doing. So it was something that drawn on, I was interested in exploring something that comes from the personal, brought out and shared, with in a common type of experience. So that's why I went into studying. acting. And it was extremely useful experience, very, very useful experience.
Excellent.
Because it's a little bit like going into psychoanalysis, actually.
Yes.
This type of study, because you learn, you know, what moved you and how to bring it out and how to share it. So it was a very, very interesting experience.
So you bring this acting experience, the method of Utahagen, to your directing. I mean, I know we know you on this show particularly as the producer of Bitter Honey, but you have also directed a number of things. And is the acting basis, is that what you're telling us, is sort of helps you to communicate with actors and get what you need from them?
Definitely. I mean, that was also the original purpose of following this type of study, was to understand how to work with actors. But my more specific interest was to understand how to work with emotions.
Uh-huh.
Something extremely, extremely useful when you are in a documentary type of situation working with other people. It's good to be able to identify when people are feeling, what people are feeling, and how to be able to bring that out without hurting people, without, you know, just finding ways of working with them so that they are real, that they are not just answering questions because you asked them, asked them something. You know, you need to build a relationship where people feel comfortable and they can be emotional if they need to be, they can be relaxed or tense, you know, all of these things. And it's important to be able to recognize when these emotions are real.
Yes.
So I think that that type of study really, really helped that.
And now you're based in California. You've had years.
I'm based in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I've been based in Los Angeles for very many years now, about 20 years. And I've been doing a lot of work in commercial advertising here too, which is something completely different, but very interesting too.
Yes, but still requires that conversational quality.
It requires that quality, and it also requires a very, very high standard of quality of work produced.
Yes.
As I moved more into producing, I became interested in seeing, you know, really how good you can make something, and from a technical standpoint. And, you know, advertising is pretty much as good as it gets. You know, because when you're working in advertising, you have a lot of resources, a lot of personnel. Production values have to be extremely high because it's such a competitive market.
Yes.
So I engaged with that world for a while, and, you know, I've always been trying to merge this highly professional, highly competitive world with the world of emotions too, which is, you know, how I came into documentaries, of course.
Excellent. So you were a founder and member of Pavlov. Tell us about that.
Yes, Pavlov Productions was an interesting experiment that was done at Sony Pictures Imageworks. Sony Pictures Imageworks is one of the biggest and, you know, more important movie studios in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, they have a very specific and regimented type of culture.
Uh-huh.
They are used to creating very big tentpole movies. You know, the studio used to be TriStar. It used to be, yes, it's a historical type of studio.
Yes.
A movie studio. It was acquired, Sony acquired TriStar, and then it turned it into Sony Pictures Entertainment. So they have a very regimented type of culture of filmmaking.
Uh-huh.
But during the late 90s, they decided advertising became very big and very profitable, of course.
Yes.
And they decided that they wanted to try and establish a boutique company to make, to produce in-house advertising and advertising for other companies too.
Mm.
So I was in hired along with two other people to establish this boutique company, which was very challenging enterprise.
Yes.
It did work out very well. The company, you know, sustained itself for 5 years, during which time we produced commercials for a lot of major, major American brand, you know, Kellogg's, Range Rover, Toyota, you name it, we worked on it.
McDonald's, Nabisco,
McDonald's,
Chrysler.
Nabisco, you know, all the big companies.
That's
This was very interesting also because we had Sony Pictures at the time was also just beginning to put together their digital division, which is called Sony Pictures Imageworks.
Uh-huh.
And we worked in collaboration with Imageworks a lot, which means we were able to offer clients, you know, very competitive visual effects work. So that was a time when I also learned a lot about visual effects and
sure.
graphics. You know, so really I would say that throughout my life I've always pursued different things and moved with the sort of flow of the industry, you know, which
yes.
I think is what one needs to do in order to survive as a producer in this type of climate. So.
And all of this, I guess, really was leading toward your putting on the producer's hat. It seems to all have led to that road, including independently managing a wide range, actually, of diverse projects. Who were some of your clients that you've worked with that you remember as a great positive challenge or whatever?
I have had the great fortune of working with some great people once I decided and realized that my strength was really in producing.
Uh-huh.
And once I realized how creative the producing job really is,
yes,
which is something I think a lot of people don't think of. You know, they think of a producer as somebody that, you know, has a budget and they just carry things out.
Yes.
But actually, there is a great range of expertise that comes with producing and fun. It's a very fun job in the sense of, you know, there are many opportunities to make things go one way or another way. So it's a very creative job. It's a very important job to do. So I had the fortune of working with, you know, Klaus Kinski, Oliver Stone, Wayne Wang, Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, just a lot of really, really talented artists. So that's, you know, I've been very fortunate that way.
I'm glad you brought...
Eventually...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
It's like being at an Italian family gathering. we keep jumping in, but that's good. I love that. But I'm glad you brought up the need for audience to appreciate, if not completely understand, the differences between directors and producers. A producer is a lot more creative position than people give it credit for, so I'm glad we touched on that. I wonder, you're currently a freelance producer and a filmmaker.
Yeah.
What do you mean by, because I love this phrase, but tell us, what do you mean by on-the-ground production? I love that.
Okay, on-the-ground production is, it means that when you have, there's different types of production.
Yes.
There's a production that consists of, the first type is consists of gathering the money to carry out a project.
Yes.
That's the production, too. Then there is figuring out how the job would be done, which can be done anywhere. You know, I could be carrying out a job in India and I could be preparing for this job here in Los Angeles by sitting at the computer, making phone calls, talking to people and, you know, sending out emails. But then there comes the point when everything is ready to go, you have the money, the job is prepped, and, you know, as I call it, you hit the ground running. You arrive at the locations where you have decided the job is going to take place, and you begin to work there, and that's on-the-ground production. So you have to coordinate people, resources, you know, everything that happens connected with making a film or a documentary in selected locations. You know, with documentaries, it's it can be very involved because resources are very often limited, you know, budgets are very small for documentary work.
Yes.
So you put a lot of work into prepping the job, and then you hope that when you arrive there, what you have done has worked out. But,
yes.
You know, many times things are very different once you arrive in a place. You know, I can be here, like when we do the work with Robert, you know, we can be here and we talk to our team in Bali and we've been there many times. And
yes.
You arrive with certain expectations, and, you know, 90% of the time, things are different. Somebody you were supposed to interview is sick, or,
yes.
you know, they're not going to show up on time, or they are not going to show up at all.
Exactly.
Or, you know, all kinds of things happen. And actually, that's the beauty of it.
Yes.
You know, that's what makes the project really alive, is to be able to manage the unpredictability of it, to live with it and to manage it. That's when something is very fresh.
You yes.
know, this type of thing translates very well onto the screen and onto an audience, you know.
And it helps to have that appreciation of improvisation in your background.
Certainly,
yeah.
absolutely. You know, there are a lot of producers that don't do very well with this, you know, that they like to have everything completely laid out.
Yes.
And if something sways away from what has been planned, it becomes problematic. I am definitely not that person.
Not only that, you are a mountain climber, yes?
Yes. That is my biggest passion of all, you know.
And you've climbed, among other places, you've been a mountaineer on the Tibetan side of Mount Everest?
I have been a mountaineer on the Tibetan side of Mount Everest in 2006.
Wow.
This was possibly the most extraordinary personal experience of my life.
Wow.
And it was, again, I keep, you know, using the word fortunate, but I've been very fortunate to have this opportunity. You know, it's very difficult to climb on that side, even just the logistics of it are very challenging. There is no helicopter rescue, so if anything happens, you're on your own. And it's, you know, the weather is very often worse than it is on the Nepalese side. But the thing is, you know, the mountain has been closed. They closed it during the Olympics.
Yes.
Because because the Tibetans were having, you know, it was problematic for the Chinese to deal with the Tibetans.
Sure.
So the mountain was closed on that side, and now it's been closed on the Nepalese side, you know, because of problems with the Sherpas and because of global warming, really.
Yes.
The biggest problem with that mountain is global warming. That's why there are avalanches.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's what happened there.
It's quite a passion, I have to say. It definitely gives you a POV.
It gives you a POV. It gives you, you know, it gives you this edge of endurance.
Yes.
That you need in production.
And trusting yourself and your judgment. I mean, it's wow.
And your team.
Yes.
Because when you're climbing, you know, you're alone, but you have people that are really close to you.
Sure.
They may be few, but they are key in your survival.
Before we, and we are, I promise, going to talk about Bitter Honey, reminding everyone that Alessandra is the producer of Bitter Honey, a feature-length documentary, which Robert Lemelson directed, and she is also a regular contributor to Elemental Productions, which produced Bitter Honey. But before we go to that, and maybe even before we have to take a break, tell me a bit about Brave New World. I know it's 6 episodes, and my impression of it, to see what you think, I called it Architecture as Artistic History of Culture. How does that sound?
I think that sounds really great. I love that.
Well, that's how it impressed me.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very interesting project. I was approached by Mina Chow, who is a professor of architecture at USC, that's University of Southern California.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted to try and make a series of programs that would educate people about historic aspects of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing about Los Angeles is everything is very new, and when people think of Los Angeles, they think of a very new place.
Yes.
Where everything is about innovation.
Yes.
And, you know, when something is being remodeled, it's normally torn down and rebuilt from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is true in some ways, but it's also not true in other ways. So her idea was to try and make theories that would really explain what innovation is in architecture. And, you know, there can be innovation that is historical, like the Bradbury building, for example.
Yes.
That we have shot in this, our pilot episode. You know, there are a lot of, there is a lot of innovation, but there are also a lot of very historical landmarks of architecture in LA.
Yes.
And so we were trying to put these two things together to really make people understand the importance of maintaining a sense of history and a memory of history, along with progressing and keep building innovation.
Excellent.
So that's what that series is going to be about. Having said that, we have not been able to finance it yet, but we're hoping to do so very soon. So.
All right. We're going to take a break right there. Stay with us, everyone. We are talking to the producer of Bitter Honey, a feature-length documentary produced by Elemental Productions in L.A. And Elemental Productions is a company that specializes in documentaries on the effects of globalization on culture and health in developing countries. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Alessandra.
And now, another film rental discovery. Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Get Low feels like it was a fun project from the beginning. Originally, the screenwriter's intentions may have been serious, but at some point, someone must have called in several of their big star friends and said, "Hey, let's have some fun." This is the story of Felix and Maddie, played here by Robert Duvall and Sissy Spacek, who long ago were in love. A bad thing happened which tore them apart. Felix became a recluse, about whom the town made up scary stories. It's a comedic takeoff on Duvall's first film role in To Kill a Mockingbird, and older Boo Radley. Nearing the end of his life, a near-death incident spurs Felix to plan his own funeral party. Yes, funeral party, which he intends to attend. It seems having been a hermit with a farm has left him a man of means. With means, you can do crazy things. And now the fun begins. When Bill Murray bursts onto the scene as a crooked funeral director slash party planner, the film introduces the quirky comedic elements that make it work. There may be a serious message here somewhere, but most of all, Get Low is simply worthy entertainment. And it's fun to see some of the great actors of our time displaying their talents while so obviously having fun. Independent film, where the real stories are told. You can find us on the web at indiefilmminute.com.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio, where I just was so fascinated with our guest's background through theater and improvisation and Utahagen and commercials, advertising, and now the producer of Bitter Honey. So we are going to talk about Bitter Honey and what she, Alessandra Pasquino, contributed as producer of Bitter Honey. It documents three different families over a seven-year period, all of which the three different families practice or live in a polygamous marriage. How about we take it from there, Alessandra?
Yes, this project is a very unique undertaking. Director Robert Lemelson is an anthropologist.
Yes.
And a professor at UCLA.
Yes.
And he approached me to see if we could work together on a documentary, on an ethnographic type of film, which means it has a very specific approach to filming and to dealing with subjects. He wanted to make a film in Bali, but he wanted to really try and do something that would merge a more sort of traditional film industry type of style, assembling a documentary along with ethnography.
Yes.
So this was, you know, of course, a challenge with the background that I have. I took it on as a big challenge because the academic world and the entertainment world are very different environments.
Yes.
They are very different cultures.
Yes.
So the idea of trying to merge these two environments was appealing to me, of course. And so that's kind of how we met and how we started talking about this project. you know, he said that he had done a lot of research in Bali, and, you know, he had a lot of potential great subjects.
Yes.
And he started reviewing some material and, you know, agreed that doing something on polygamy would be very interesting, both from the academic standpoint and, you know, polygamy as a subject is such an unusual type of idea to be dealing with in a film in the U.S.
Yes,
so
yes.
I thought, let's do it. Let's try it out.
I know.
So, you know, so we went to Bali several times, and we met, you know, some of the families that were already selected, some more that were, some more subjects that we selected, and we started conducting interviews. This went on for a very long time.
Yes.
Robert told you it's taken several years to have enough really great material to put it together in a proper narrative that makes sense. So that's how it all started.
And I wonder, and forgive me for what probably seems like a predictable, if not silly question, but from the viewpoint of a woman, how did you react to this? What, you know, you bring your professional mountain climbing and producing skills and commercial experience, et cetera, but also there had to be, I would think, a female response to seeing, and I guess we should stress that only about 10% of the families in Bali practice polygamous marriage, so it's not like the whole country is that way, but there are, polygamy is a style of marriage that is embraced over a pretty large area of the world, according to Robert Lemelson, the director, but certainly not one that is appreciated, shall we say, or practiced or even talked about much in America. So as a California lady, how did you respond to this?
Well, I tell you what I found very interesting when I started thinking about this subject was that, as you mentioned and as Robert said, polygamy is not very widespread in Bali.
Yes.
But the idea of men or husband having more than one partner, it is very common in the West.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I started to think about it. I started to think about how many of my girlfriends are married and have found themselves in situations where their husband, you know, started to have relations with another girl,
uh-huh.
and then another girl. You know, this just happened. It
yes.
happens a lot. It's a very common situation in the West. It's just that
you don't marry them. Yes.
Deals with it very differently.
Yes.
But it is the sort of exact same thing, you know, in the heart of a person. You know, women get as much hurt.
Sure.
As they do there, they just put up with it differently, you know.
You know, I'm glad you make that point, because I thought that when talking to Robert. I don't think I ever said it because I just didn't think it was a thing to say, but you have said it, and I want to say I couldn't agree more. The reality is, Bitter Honey is talking about several wives, in addition to prostitutes, but we'll get there later, several wives for one man, but in America, many men, not all, but certainly many men have mistresses and cheat on their wives. They just don't marry them. But the result for the wife, at least wife number one, is pretty much the same. Yes? As you were saying.
It is the same. And, you know, to me, the issue at hand was, why do men do this?
Yes.
So that's what was interesting for me. And, you know, I wanted, as a producer in the film, when I was interviewing people and engaging in discussions with Rob and the editor and everybody on how the film would, the story would shape up, you know, I always kept in mind this investigation of trying to find out why people do it.
Yes.
What motivates men to do this? And, you know, in Bali, there is the whole karma. There is a very clear cultural explanation. And what I learned by working with Robert was that, you know, every place has a different cultural explanation. You
yes.
can't generalize about men just do this. Now, men will do this in Bali, and they will have a completely, you know, a different motivation, perhaps, if they do it in the West, or
yes.
in America, or in Italy, or wherever it is. I mean, there are some basic thinks that would probably be the same. But there are also some very strong cultural components that either justify or condemn this, perpetuate it, you know, that sort of thing. Now, so this was very interesting aspect of this job, you know, to
yes.
sort of remember and investigate why men do this, what drives them to do it, you know. Do they hide it? Do they don't hide it? You know, because there's so much deception involved in these relationships, you know. So again, this was interesting for me, bringing it back to the sort of work that I did, you know, with acting and emotions, about hiding emotions or exposing them, you know. Very, very interesting.
You know what I find interesting? I must confess before I ask another question. I was just hit between the eyes by you when you said, why do men do this? Because, as you may very well know from my in my interview with Robert, who directed Bitter Honey, one of my first questions was, why do women do this? So that, very interesting. So you ask, why do men do this? And I ask, why do women do this? And here we are talking. This is getting even more interesting than I expected. Karma, the old royal families, tradition, you know, as I often say, Americans think the world is America, and it isn't. But how, I'm still just hit with that, why do men do this? That is an excellent question, and I'm kind of embarrassed that I didn't ask it, but my question was, why do women? So for the moment, I'm going to ask you my question, which is, why do women do it? But first, to repeat what you said, there's a tremendous amount of deception, including many of the wives, wife number 2, 3, 4, 5, don't know that their husbands already have a wife at home when he dates and in some cases impregnates, but proposes and marries them. Yes?
Right, absolutely. I mean, that was a standard in the film
yes.
we produced in Bali, you know, where men would go out and go on a date with a girl and never reveal that they were married. Sometimes they didn't reveal it for a really long time, and they never revealed it. Like, a girlfriend of the girl would say something.
Oh.
You know, somebody in the village would mention it. So deception was one of the components of this type of relationship.
Yes.
And honestly, it is very similar here. You know, a lot of men will go and find the mistress, and the mistress won't know for a while that this is a married man.
Exactly.
You know, it happens.
Oh, yes.
I think that, you know, a lot of what motivates this is some sort of personal greed and search for self-esteem. You know, I don't know exactly what it is, but I know it is a universal thing.
It is. I mean, it's no different than, although perhaps it's taken this conversation with you to make me see it completely in this way, but it's no different than a man going to a bar and taking off his wedding band and picking up someone and thinking that's fine. The only difference is he goes back to his wife and hopefully has practiced safe sex if he must do something like this. But in Bali, there is a big difference. It seems, in addition to the additional wives, that many of the men, the husbands with several wives, still go to see prostitutes and have sex without contraception. Is that
right?
Yeah.
I mean, for me, the big question with the man was during the film, and is, you know, if I think about it here, how do the men justify themselves?
Yes. Yes.
You know, with themselves. They can justify themselves with the wife. They can come up with some idea. But the question is, how do you in your heart justify deceiving somebody? In Bali, you know, there is a whole karma type of explanation of, you know, oh, I am not really the agent of my actions, which is an interesting interpretation of karma, too.
Yes.
Because actually, you know, karma from a Buddhist standpoint
yes.
means the exact opposite. It means that you are totally, totally responsible of your actions because they produce consequences.
Exactly.
You know, but in the West, where we don't really have this concept of karma,
uh-huh.
how do men justify with themselves? doing something like this? How can they live with it? Now that's, to me, the interesting question.
Exactly, and continue to look in the mirror and find no problem with it. I think there must be, which may be related to the husbands in Bali as well, but there must be some sense of, certainly power is part of what polygamous husbands in Bali are, but in other cultures, in the Western culture, maybe it is, as you say, self-esteem, the need to prove they still have it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that is certainly my impression.
Uh-huh.
That there is something to do with self-esteem, with identity, you know, with feeling wanted, you know. I mean, maybe a lot of men are in very unhappy situations, I'm not saying, you know, there can be a lot of immediate motivations, but the question is why you do it. There's other options.
Yes.
You know, if you don't get along with somebody, you need to work it out. And if you can't work it out, then maybe you shouldn't be there.
Yes.
I mean, women suffer very much
yes.
in this type of situation. And, you know, whether they have jobs or not, whether they have children or not, it's just not a good situation to be in. You know, the sexual is not good.
And women suffer, whether it's in the Western culture or Eastern or Bali or Indonesia, the women are the ones who suffer the most. What can we hope for in a new generation? I guess we should remind each other again and all our listeners that in Bali, we're talking about only 10% of families live in a polygamous marriage. And in America, we hope only 10% of men cheat on their wives. I would like to think the percentage is that low. But what about the next generation, both in the West and in places like Bali? Is education catching up? Is the culture changing? What do you see as the evolution?
Well, I mean, the culture is constantly changing, and, you know, I see as every relationships are constantly changing
mm-hmm.
because the culture is changing. And I think what I would like to, what I advocate for is truth and honesty.
Yes.
You know, and trying to live your life without fear.
Yes.
Because people are motivated by fear a lot of times when they, in their actions, you know, they don't want to talk to the wife because they're afraid.
Yes.
They don't want to come out of they don't want to get divorced or, you know, because they're afraid. They're afraid to be alone. They're afraid to hurt somebody even more. You know, there's all these different types of fears that move people.
Yes.
So it's very difficult to sort of exist without fear. So I hope that, you know, somehow there will be a movement in people's hearts towards finding a personal way to live your life without fear and in honesty and, you know, with a pure heart. I'm not saying it's easy.
No. It's certainly not easy.
It's definitely not easy.
But I think it is one of the underlining messages of Bitter Honey. I should explain,
yeah.
I'm fascinated with the title. I understand the title because I've seen the documentary. Do you want to give away what the title means?
When in Bali, when men take on another wife, it's a honey.
Yes.
So we have decided to name it Bitter Honey
yes.
because in this particular situation, it is obviously a very bitter moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great title.
It really is. And I have to say also one of the other differences that makes this particularly bitter in Bali is that there, if a woman gets a divorce in Bali, she loses everything, including the possibility of losing her children, yes?
Yes. Now, the law is changing. It's moving towards supporting women who want to come out of this type of situation, like, you know, if they want to get divorced, the law is moving towards helping them and towards being more towards equal rights. It's
uh-huh.
not there yet, but it's working. It's moving towards that. We are hoping that this film is going to bring awareness onto the subject.
Yes.
We're working with some in the community in Bali, where the film was shot, and in other areas where polygamy occurs. We're showing the film, we are working with local advocates and legal counselors, and, you know, we're trying to put together a little movement. I mean,
sure.
We are not. We are trying to help
yes.
people come together to do something like this on the ground. Obviously, we're here. Our situation is very different. All we can do is push to show the movie and to try and get people together and hope that they do come together in making a change and in allowing, you know, women to get divorced and keep the children.
Yes.
Which is, you know, a key factor here.
Absolutely. You know, we've sort of run out of time, Alessandra. It has been an excellent conversation and enlightening, and especially I want to repeat for all who might have let it slip by, the question is not just why do the women do it when it comes to polygamy and putting up with cheating husbands in the West, but why do the men do it? And secondly, that film, especially documentary, but commercials too, let's face it, can change opinions and change minds and enlighten and change society. And it is while you were on the ground, you and Robert and the film crew working on Bitter Honey in Bali, that you actually got requests from some of the women for help, and you were able to put them together, as you say, with a potential, at least social services solutions. And I just think it's an amazing job you're doing, and it's incredible work. Before we go, though, perhaps there's some kind of website or something, information you want to give us in addition to Bitter Honey for you out there in California?
Yes, I mean, there is the film's website. It's bitterhoneythefilm.com.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is, well, my website is alessandraparquino.com. And then, of course, there is the website of our production company, which is elementalproductions.org.
Pasquino. We should perhaps spell that for our non-Italian friends.
Yes, that is P as in Paul, A-S-Q-U-I-N-O.
Very good.
And the And the first name is Alessandra, A-L-E-S-S-A-N-D-R-A.
Yes. It has been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and I hope one day we get to work together, and I certainly look forward to another conversation, that's for sure.
Thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you. Bye now, and best in all you're doing.
Bye. Thank you very much. Take care.
Okay.
Stay with us, as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice. And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Interestingly enough, 13 was originally budgeted at $3 million. As always, money was hard to come by, and the budget had to be reduced in stages to only $500,000. Some say that such restrictions can invigorate art, and 13 provides proof to the point. This is an effective and powerful film that will terrify any parent of a teenage girl who dares to press play. This semi-autobiographical screenplay was co-written by Nikki Reed, who co-stars with Evan Rachel Wood and Holly Hunter. Both Wood and Reed were only 14 at the time. It's a story of a broken home, and parents who, though they love their daughter, are too self-absorbed to earn their title. Their daughter pays the price as she searches for all the children search for at that age. Nature abhors a vacuum, as we know, and into the void slithers the embodiment of everything we fear for our children, a character who provides a twisted version of all that is sought. 13 is so powerfully affecting that after its Sundance premiere, attendees were heard calling their daughters from the lobby of the theater. We know that this film has impacted parents it has touched, perhaps even with a longer-lasting effect than the trauma of their immediate film experience. Indie Film Minute, not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Voter ID, MIA Surgeon General, Ebola Panic. Ebola is not worthy of our national panic button. However, NRA-dominated congressional conservatives blocking the nomination of Dr. Vivek Murthy as Surgeon General is grounds for alarm over low voter turnout in 2014. In America, Ebola has killed one man and wounded two nurses. But if we must panic, Alzheimer's, brain-robbing millions, is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. Police police shoot and kill more than Ebola, as do drunk drivers, texting teens, domestic violence, and airline crashes. But if panic is to be our new American pastime, on November 4th, vote for leaders who deactivate hyperlink between high school dropouts and privatized prisons. Vote knowing it was the board of a for-profit private hospital that voted no admittance for Thomas Duncan if we must panic. Choose more rational targets, like the oxidation of our brains by the greed of pharmaceutical pill-pushing companies that bombard reason with so much overstated and questionable advertising, we are Ebola distracted from what is really killing us. For example, sugar and diabetes, a K Street ALEC judiciously handicapping the elderly, university students, minorities, and our electoral system with voter ID laws. Obesity and malnutrition, failing to honor the physically and mentally wounded veteran with affordable health care as much as we memorialize war dead with monuments. Filibuster, congressional gridlock, government shutdown, and a 5-4 politicized Supreme Court. Sequestration, gouging NIH budget to find cures for disease. Ignorance of the facts and being too lazy to research for the truth. All forms of discrimination, prejudice, bias against those who look, think, preach, act, or marry differently than we. And finally, food corporations with advertising so bottom-line oriented, we are addicted to the very things that kill everything except our panic. Arguably, the aforementioned is corporatism's defining moment, and we define ourselves by how we allow corporate America to transform our eating, drinking, and election habits. Thus, we get the government we failed to vote for by leaving the choices to those who do. We get the government we are too issue misinformed about to cast justice for all ballots. We get the government we settle for because flag-waving and repeating Americans this slogans and family values that cliches are easier than committing daily acts of random constitutional spirit toward one another. Voting, like driving, loving, hating, and panicking, are choices and/or privileges, but not rights. Rights are what's guaranteed us in our U.S. Constitution. Unless we the people allow, through our inaction, our ignorance of history's revisionists, our knowledge of the dangers of redistricting, or just blissfully succumbing to the redirection of misinformation, settle for being subjugated by the repetitious re-election of supremacist-oriented conservatives, addicted to corporate money and political power, by the way, then on November 4th, 2014, we will honor those hungry, underpaid, and often shoeless original Americans who fought against tyranny even before there was an America. And we accomplish this by voting and helping others to vote, especially the elderly and college-age students. Then truly we will be the home of the brave and not the panicked. Let's strike a ballot blow for rational thought against media hype and defeat both political and Wall Street Madison Avenue corporate commercials that both brainwash and brain damage before we're all brain dead. With each vote, we can denounce the revolting, revolving door from Congress to corporatism's rewards. Let's not diminish ourselves with the irrelevance of right direction poll questions. Instead, let's renounce panic, let go of hype, and vote ourselves forward into fixing fixed voting machines, attending to our neglected infrastructure, sharing both affordable health care and voting privileges with truth and justice for all Americans. Now please visit thereasonablevoice.com website and listen to the episode of Charlottesville This Week entitled Ebola Facts Cancel Panic. You might also want to stop by our Blog Talk Radio podcasts for Alzheimer's Kills More Americans Than Ebola. Either way, join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of thereasonablevoice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.